victim's impact statement, is this before the real trial, or is this at the pre-sentencing?
It's at the sentencing. After conviction, and before, it's at the day of sentencing. Sometimes, in some states, you have conviction and sentencing in the same time. It goes right into it. In New York, you have conviction now, and in about a month or 6 weeks, you go back for sentencing. Sometimes the sentencing is done by the judge, sometimes it's done by the jury. In capital murder cases, there's usually a second process where the jury has to go back and deliberate just on that issue and then come back with their verdict. Once they know he's guilty, then they go back to determine how what the level of sentencing will be. Yes?
Can they read these letters? Like in Ohio, we get the big press usually when the victim's family stands up and they read the letters. And
yes.
It's very emotional, and it just feels good finally that they were able to tell.
To have their say.
Yes.
Because they are not recognized in the courtroom. They just sit there. They have no legal right to say anything or do anything. It's the district attorney representing them. As I said before, you can't have your own lawyer. So you have all your faith in a one-shot deal. You don't get a second chance at this unless you have a hung jury. So you only have that one opportunity to tell everybody, tell the whole world, that for the last 3 weeks, all these things the defense attorney said were complete lies about my loved one. And this is how they really are. And this is what I want you to know about them. And that helps them emotionally, no doubt about it. There are some families that have said to me, I can't do this. I cannot stand up and do this. And I said, that's okay. You have options. Have another person from the group do it for you. I've done it for some families. Have someone on the district attorney's staff do it for you. There are options. Have a person in the crime victims unit do it for you. But have it done. Don't bypass it. I tell them you should go to trial because it's been proven that juries look for the victim's family. I tell them move to the front and stay there and let them know that you're there and it means that much to you, because there definitely has been a higher conviction rate when they know somebody's concerned about that case. I'd like to go a little bit into the challenges of day-to-day. Let's look at some of the emotional, a lot of which I've already mentioned. In the beginning, of course, shock, numbness, complete. I mean, this is incomprehensible to anyone. Nobody tells you how to handle this when you're, you know, growing up. There's no college class that tells you how to deal with this. There's no master's degree class that teaches you. Nobody says, one day when your stepdaughter is murdered, this is what you're going to do to survive it. Nobody can, unfortunately, teach you the skills you need. You have to learn what works for you along the way. You can learn from others. You can gain their experience, which is why homicide support groups are so valuable, because you're listening to another mother, another dad, another sister or brother tell you, this is what worked for me, this did not work for me. You take that all in, you go home, and you try to live the next 2 weeks, 4 weeks. Until you meet again. You get to a homicide group to dump, to vent. You need that option. You need to be able to say, this is how I would kill him. I would peel the skin off of him. And people do that. They need to say those things. It's shocking for a lot of counselors to be able to listen to that. And that's why it's so difficult to find counselors who can handle that over a long period of time. It's just that simple. The anger, the rage, the uncontrollable rage, what do you do with it? Where does it go? How can you get that out of you? It's so difficult because you don't really know who most to be angry at. You go through all those what-ifs that a lot of people in grief go through. Well, if I had just lived closest to her, you know, my husband said, well, maybe if I wasn't divorced. My stepson once said that to me. That was very frightening. He said, Dad, you know, maybe if you and Mommy were still married, this would not have happened. You know, and that children think like that, and adults think like that. And you go through all those shoulda, coulda, wouldas, you know, and if only I did this, and if only, you know, she didn't look older than her age, if only she didn't wear this kind of clothes, if only I didn't let her go to the store, if, and it doesn't make a difference, but you have to go through all of that. And so you fight, you have this internal struggle between who am I blaming here? Am I blaming me because of what I think I should have done to protect her? Or am I blaming the criminal, which is rightfully where the blame should be, but I want to get to that point, but I still rocking back and forth between where the blame should go and where the guilt's coming in, and now I'm a basket case. So, let's take a Valium, go to bed for 4 days, and this is real life. This is what happens. There were times when my husband could not function, didn't get out of bed for weeks. You like to think that, you know, they put on a pretty face and you go to work and you come home, and there are plenty of people who do that, but they drop. And sooner or later it hits them. The realization starts to click in after the shock is starting to wear down. And stabilization is not 6 months or 8 months. Or sometimes even a year. Stabilization can take up to 2 years. And when I say stabilization, I'm talking about where I can get up and function on a pretty even keel basis, and I know that this is the way it's going to be. Yes?
Do you think that some of that frustration comes from, it seems like when people die, we go to our logical reasoning and go, well, they were old. They had cancer, something out of our control. But you can't ever get to the logical reason why they were killed.
Right.
The logical reason, there's no
logical reason here. There's no reasoning here.